Louisiana became the latest state this week to ban abortion after 6 weeks before most women know they're pregnant. Louisiana joins half a dozen other states that have recently passed similar laws. Let's look at what's happening in the context of what has happened in the past with historians Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, because what we hear about abortion typically is what's happened in the last few decades. But what about abortion in early America, Nathan?
Well, we don't have any explicit references to abortion in, say, English language medical guides in colonial America. You get things, maybe recipes for things like restoring menstruation, for example, using herbs to stimulate women's periods, which often will then serve as aborticides. So imagine women who might drink a tea with an herb like savin or other kinds of herbs. In German language medical guides, there are slightly more direct references. Just to give you one example, Christopher Sauer has a book called Small Herbal of Little Cost, printed in Germantown in Pennsylvania. And just to be clear, about one-third of the population of women in Pennsylvania speak German, so this is not an incidental volume. But it really does describe how one will, quote-unquote, expel the dead fruit, right? So it's very explicit. And this is running, you know, these kinds of manuals through the late 18th century, all kinds of midwifery manuals, and really trying to find ways of giving women somewhat safer measures for basically ending a pregnancy. The other thing I'll say about this is we have very few personal accounts of abortion, but there are a few. And just one quick example, one woman named Coates Pashal, she's writing in the 1750s about an abortion she had maybe 20 years earlier. And she just uses, you know, really kind of gripping language about having, quote, very bad and violent pain in the back and bowels for 3 months with child. And then she's basically given a kind of herbal enema as a way to end the pregnancy. And it's seen as being, again, a way of ensuring women's health and not part of a larger effort to basically bring about autonomous women's actions in, say, the commercial arena.
And that was in the middle of the 18th century, as you said. But in 1821, Brian, Connecticut becomes the first state to ban abortion. How does that come about?
Well, it comes about through the really immoral and bad actions of a man, you'll be shocked to hear, and not only a man, but a minister. He was ministering to an older woman who was dying, and while doing that, he had an affair with that woman's granddaughter, 30 years younger. When the woman became pregnant that he was having an affair with, he insisted that she go through these herbal procedures to abort the fetus. When that did not happen, he resorted to mechanical abortion, actually using a device. That did not work immediately. She did eventually give a birth to a fetus that was stillborn, and by then he had beat it out of town. Now, folks in Connecticut were absolutely outraged by this behavior. And so when they went to try to prosecute this guy, they learned that there really were no laws on the book against this. And that's how we got this law in 1821. And what the law said was that it banned medicinal abortion, the kind that Nathan was just talking about. And it banned it after quickening. Quickening is when the mother could begin to feel movements on the part of the fetus, usually happening about midway through the pregnancy. And Connecticut was the first, but other states soon followed, New York in 1829 and a whole bunch of them after that in the 19th century.
And then once you get into the 20th century, but before Roe versus Wade, what was the state of abortion in the United States, Nathan?
Well, in the 1930s, you begin to see sharp increases in both legal and illegal abortions during the Great Depression. And you can obviously, you know, make some connections there again with women needing to participate more fully in the workplace and not wanting to be sidelined by a pregnancy or thinking about the dangerous health consequences given the absence of safe health care for many women during that time. What's interesting, though, is even among working class women, there are almost identical rates of abortion among Catholic and Jewish and Protestant women, that there's no real religious breakdown, as one might imagine, given the problems that, you know, ethnic Catholic families might raise for their daughters seeking abortions or those kinds of things. And then, of course, there's the question of race, which is never far from the table, especially in the 1930s. You have one doctor, Edgar Bass Kiemer. He's a doctor from Detroit, and he has an abortion clinic that he runs between the 30s and the 70s, and he's really targeting black poor women for about 35 years, helping them get access to these abortion services, and again, because there's largely a denial of their access to white physicians. He performs over 30,000 abortions, and he basically makes the argument that when he was early in his career and denied a woman access to this, the woman turned around and committed suicide, and it made him somewhat of a crusader in this arena. Ultimately, he's actually tried and convicted for performing what is ultimately an illegal service at the time in mid-century. In the 1950s, he goes to jail for about 14 months. Hmm. And rather than becoming a test case for the question of abortion rights for physicians more broadly, he ends up being race-baited through the proceedings when they're able to discover that he basically is performing some of these services on white women. So the idea of a black man touching a white woman's quote-unquote private parts is anathema before the courts. And so he really is given the harshest sentence possible at the time.
Interesting. Now, a couple decades after that, we get to the part of the story that everybody knows, which is Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court case. It was a 7-2 opinion that said that basically abortion was a constitutional right. Brian, what was the response, the public response after Roe v. Wade?
Well, it was two-pronged, as you might imagine. There was great celebration on the part of women, but there was also a very organized effort that had begun before the decision, Jeremy, to push back by the Catholic Church. You know, polling showed that Catholics actually supported the decision being left to the woman and her physician by a slim majority, 64% of the overall population. In the immediate wake of the decision, Jeremy, actual support for the decision about an abortion being left to the woman increased. Within a few years, it was up to 67% of the American population.
So what do you make of what we're seeing now, and especially in the last decade or so, a huge spike in anti-abortion legislation, and especially in the last, you know, couple of months? Just it seems like it's happening very quickly now that there is a conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
Well, what I left out was what happened in politics. For starters, Richard Nixon, going back to his reelection campaign in 72, recognized that there were segments of the white ethnic population, that quote, forgotten man that Nixon was trying to appeal to, that really would support right to life. And he began campaigning on this issue. It obviously took off under Ronald Reagan and his campaign for, quote, family values. And a man who went on to be very influential on this issue on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, actually worked for Ronald Reagan and wrote a very important memo that laid out a strategy for beginning to win back the fight against abortion by going state to state. And that is very much where we are today.
And Nathan, do you think that, you know, here we are in 2019, do you think that we're on the verge of seeing Roe versus Wade overturned by the Supreme Court?
What's interesting, I think, now is obviously the case law that, you know, we're looking at is one in which you have certain cases in the 1990s, particularly Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, that's allowing the court to uphold abortion but still rewrite some of the standards of protection. So the struggle going forward will be about on what terms is abortion rights, if it is going to exist, going to be protected. So will there be more hurdles to jump, or will there simply be, you know, an effort to try to make the standards that seem clearly articulated in Roe remain the law of the land? I mean, I think in some ways the concerns that were raised around Brett Kavanaugh being appointed to the court were seen as being, you know, ground zero for what the anti-abortion fault lines will be in the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. And I think in a similar way, you know, what's happening in the electoral arena with more women arriving in the House and possibly even in the Senate in 2020, that's going to obviously create new sites of contestation on the abortion question going forward.
Although it was a woman, Senator Susan Collins, who made a very important decision that helped Brett Kavanaugh get onto the Supreme Court. So that's interesting as well. Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballo, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.